Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. There is a lot happening in our world, and we're going to talk about some of that with all of you this hour. I want to begin just by reflecting that this is a very holy time of the year for many people. Tonight begins the Jewish New Year. It is Rosh Hashanah. It also is the beginning of the end of Ramadan and the beginning of Eid. Did I pronounce that right, Derek?
Most people say Eid.
But Eid? Yeah. Okay, Eid. The festival that follows Ramadan. And usually, we're not doing it this year, but usually we try to have a conversation that crosses those lines between people to think about what this means in terms of the peace between Jews and Arabs and Muslims and Christians throughout the globe, what it says about where our country is now in terms of what Muslims face in our country, the outright hatred from many quarters they face, where over 30% of the people think that Barack Obama is a Muslim, but think about it in a negative sense. And he's not a Muslim, by the way, but think about that in a negative sense. And that there's an author I heard the other day who wrote a book about how it feels to be a minority, an Arab minority in America, and to be hated and despised as that minority in this country. And I think it's a time for real reflection on all of that, especially when we see zealots like the ones in Florida who are preparing to burn the Quran on September the 11th. And we're also approaching September 11th. 9/11 is upon us, and thinking about what that day means, and about a week after that, October the 7th, that's more than that, it's like a month after that, is the beginning of the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the war in Afghanistan. We saw today President Barack Obama talking about what he's not calling a stimulus, but is a stimulus nevertheless, but people are afraid to use that word in today's political world. Seems to be drawing the line in the sand. The question is drawing the line in the sand, is it too late for that line to be drawn for the Republicans not to be victorious on Election Day on November the 2nd? We'll look at that as well and much more with our guests here and all of you and your thoughts on all of that at 410-319-8888. In the studio, Diedrich Mohammed, who is co-founder of the Race and Economic Policy Forum. He's a senior organizer and research associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good. The Institute for Policy Studies, Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler, Dr. Richard Vatz, professor in the Department of Mass Communications and Communication Studies at Towson University, and a frequent contributor to RedMaryland.com.
Thank you, Mark.
And as I always like to say when I say RedMaryland.com, that is not a communist publication.
Thanks for that.
410-319-8888.
Thanks for clarifying that.
But you never know.
I know. I live through the Red Scare, you know.
We're living through it now. Let's.
Oh, man. That was pretty
That's good.
That was pretty good. Yeah, I got to give you some credit for that one. The New Red Scare by Mark Steiner.
That's a good op-ed. I might take that.
You can have it.
Thank you.
So, gentlemen, let's start with this. We are at this time in just about an hour or so. Services will begin in synagogues around the country, and people will be sitting down to break the fast of Ramadan as sunset comes. And we're talking about burning Qurans and the issues of what faces people of the Islamic faith in this country and people who are from Arab and Islamic nations, what they face as immigrants in this country. I'm just curious how you reflect on that moment.
Yeah, I've been
Diedrich Mohammed.
I've been thinking a lot about trying to write something about this particular Ramadan because so many things have been happening as a Muslim American with this, you know, with Ramadan ending right around September 11th, with this pastor talking about burn the Quran day, and he's trying to get other people to join in on this, and with the whole controversy around the Islamic Community Center, and experiencing all of this as you're fasting and trying to reflect. In the most holy time of the year for Muslims. And I think there's a lot to be said that really hasn't come out because we get so caught up in just the controversies. It also interests me, this whole piece about the discrimination. I mean, as an African-American who's a Muslim, I think when people see me on the street, they see me more as an African-American. Like, people used to always ask me after 9/11, was I discriminated against because of my name at the airport? And the only discrimination I felt was I get pulled over a lot, but I never felt it was because I was a Muslim, but because I was a young male who traveled a lot internationally with not a lot of luggage, and so oftentimes they thought I was a drug dealer. So I've never felt the prejudice necessarily.
But you no longer are one, is that correct?
don't travel nearly as much. But with Arab Americans, it's interesting because Arab Americans, the overwhelming majority of Arab Americans in this country are not Muslim. But yet they oftentimes are the ones who face this prejudice of against Muslims. And, you know, and no one should have to experience that. But it just kind of shows, again, how the lack of rhyme or reason behind there's something much deeper. It's not very rational, the prejudice that people are having at this time. And I think it does. It's not a coincidence that this connects with this follows the demonstrations that were happening around Arizona and kind of an overall anti-immigrant, kind of other feeling that's happening in an economy, in a bad American economy where people are people who I think are most upset with the Obama administration are really rallying. So it's bringing together a whole bunch of different issues, and I look forward to further discussion about it.
Yeah, in a very bad economy. I'm not a religious person myself. I grew up Catholic until the first Sunday I was in college, which is pretty much when everyone leaves the church. But, you know, I in line with this discussion, in this morning's New York Times, Imam Rauf of the non-Ground Zero, non-mosque, the Islamic Community Center, has written an op-ed column declaring that he and his group have decided to persist with the planned site. Whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, I'm not sure. This topic has been covered in interesting ways. In the New York Times yesterday morning on the front page, they had a story built around the views of Muslim Americans around the country about what this dispute has done in the way they are received within their communities. It opened with quoting a medical doctor in Cincinnati.
All right.
Who felt, he's never felt before that he as a Muslim was perhaps being rejected by the wider community, and he felt that perhaps it would have been wiser just to build the community center somewhere else. I must say, you know, I'm not the world's leading expert on Imam Rauf. He seems to me to be someone who expresses very decent ideals that I find are thrilling. I'm not sure it had to be right there. I mean, the community center he describes, which to me could and may still do tremendous things within New York City with folding Muslim Americans in New York into the broad fabric of New York life, it may still do tremendous things if it ever goes up at that site. Of course, it could have done those same things somewhere else, perhaps. So I'm kind of squishy soft on this as liberals go. I'm very squishy soft on it. And I say, as someone who basically comes from left to center, I think a lot of liberals have been eager to fight about this. I think it's a very bad move for liberals. I think it's not a constructive way to do politics. We live in an oligarchic society now, and as long as we divide up into two tribes, with our tribe calling the other tribe bigots and the other tribe calling our tribe godless, we're just going to be crushed by oligarchic power forever. And that's the way the cables are running it now, and that's the way the political discussion is going. I just think it's a bad thing for everybody, except for power.
Let me just say that in all the years I've been on your show, Mark, I don't ever recall 100% agreement between Bob and me on when you mentioned two issues. And so we've talked about two issues, and I'm pretty much coincident in views. Let me say about those issues a couple things. On Imam Rauf's op-ed piece today, he mentioned some things that he has not publicly gone through before, the fact that the mosque would have prayer spaces for Muslims, Jews, and Christians. The fact that there would be he also said there would be a multi-faith memorial dedicated to the victims of 9/11, which seems to be an important symbol for those who are upset that the mosque being built in Lower Manhattan. On the other hand, I do not support, you know, it doesn't matter because he has the right to do this, but I do not think it's a good idea to build a mosque there. Let me say just a couple things about the Floridian crazies. Reverend Terry Jones has about, as I understand, the 50 members in his evangelical church in Gainesville. This is 50 people out of 350 million Americans, and this is so patently offensive that he wants to burn Qurans to teach them that if you attack us, we will attack you. And if you listen to him talk, you're not surprised at the errant stupidity of this man. I mean, this is not a close call. And the Vatican has condemned this. And I have not read one reasonable person who does not find this intended action to be patently outrageous. And it is arrogant. And for him to take it upon himself to symbolically defile a religion by burning Qurans to teach Muslims, if you attack us, we'll attack you. I think this really brings together all people of good reason, because it is just outrageous. It is fatuous, his reasoning, and it is problematic. It is despicable, and every other negative adjective I can possibly come up with.
And I think it's interesting too, the way I think, since the general has come out and says that this could be endangering soldiers' lives, that I think for a lot of more conservative people who might not be big fans of Islam as a whole, this gives a more conservative critique of how are you doing something that's really just for show that could be endangering American soldiers' lives. But I want to put forward, I am glad that they're continuing on with the Islamic Center at a few blocks from Ground Zero. I think it makes sense that this imam has had a congregation in that area for years. They've been looking for a bigger place. They thought they had approval. It wasn't a big deal when it was first announced. And now, because generally right-wing news groups have promoted this as the evil mosque upon Ground Zero, now they're supposed to back away. And some people are saying, well, you know, if this is causing conflict or controversy, maybe they should just move it. Well, I think oftentimes this country's required a lot of conflict and controversy to get past prejudice and stereotypes. And so I'm glad, you know, there's a mosque four blocks away from Ground Zero. I don't know why they shouldn't be able to have
an
this community
mosque.
Center.
Huh? A mosque that already exists. Yeah, but that's different. That's different from a new mosque.
It's a new community center. And again, like when they first announced it, it wasn't much of an issue. I mean, there's even.
Why is that relevant? Why is it relevant
because
that when it was first announced, it was not much of an issue?
Gentlemen, let's not argue.
Because I don't
start
think,
of a holy season.
Because I don't think it is right that just because some people who are really looking to agitate and cause bad will bring it up now because of that, we should the whole thing should turn around and change. And I'm glad
that
it falls
on its own. I mean, it's not a question of the lack of responsibility of people who initially made it salient. I mean, the fact is that. An argument that I made in Red Maryland was if the Jewish Defense League years ago had created an act like this, and then a Jewish group wanted to create a temple in this area, it would be opposed, and rightly so, because there is that association that seems to be seems to make the action an irresponsible action.
There's no concern about some type of conservative evangelical churches being built around the place where the Oklahoma bombing occurred. These things happen all the time, right. Like all throughout the South.
Yeah, I don't find that analogous.
I completely do, because it's very clear to me that McVeigh had a very religious outlook about the government and was moving forward on that. But again, most Americans won't see that as analogous because they don't think of Christianity as one thing. They think of Islam as what they know of on the news, which is us invading Muslim countries and us fighting Osama bin Laden. So all of Islam is that. And so this kind of Sufi, very pro-Western imam who's building a community center is now somehow associated with bin Laden. And there's no reason to connect those people at all.
I don't disagree with anything that Diedrich is saying, really. Here's what I do think. Let's say you could have gone back in time a year to the point when this project was being sort of first discussed and when it was run by Mayor Bloomberg. I've often thought if Bill Clinton had been mayor of New York City at that time, he might have said to Imam Rauf and his associates, you know, there might be some negative reaction to this. Let's either try to lay the groundwork or let's look for another site where you can do what you want to do as well or better. And if you want to stay here, let's lay some groundwork. Because I think Mayor Bloomberg, it doesn't make him a bad person. Clearly he didn't see that there would be. And I don't think it's fair to assume that all the feedback comes from bigotry. Or, you know, if it's
I think the last poll I saw was 77%. If we get a country with 77% bigots, we pretty much better quit right now because there's just no point in having a discussion about anything. Right. I don't think that's really the case. That it's
I don't either.
There are bigots involved, presumably. And there's clearly are some online. I mean, there have been one or two people who have driven this are clearly just flat-out old bigots. But I just think it might have been wiser to lay some – it doesn't make anyone involved a bad person.
But, you know,
but to lay some groundwork or to whatever.
Well, I just thought this, and we'll move on to another subject. This is my thoughts on that. I mean, that because I've listened to everything everybody's been saying. And I want our listeners to join in. Any topic we've raised, please come join us, 410-319-8888. You can talk about the mosque. We're going to talk about President Barack Obama's political tactics at the moment and whether they're working or not working for America and what's about to happen. 410-319-8888 here with Dr. Richard Vatz, Bob Somerby, and Diedrich Muhammad. You're reading that book now by Martin Luther King we were talking about before we went on the air, one of the first books.
Just first book, Stride Toward Freedom.
Stride Toward Freedom. And I remember when people back in that time when I was a young civil rights worker were saying, this is a time for you to stand down, to not foment the trouble. Stop the freedom rides. Don't push. Don't do the sit-ins now. Don't have a speech that is too fiery at the March on Washington, they told John Lewis. And he actually did back down from that. He didn't give the speech he was going to give. But others didn't back down when it came to the civil rights movement. And I think about that, and I think about it only – I mean, you might not agree this is analogous.
I don't. You took words right out of my mouth. I'm sorry.
I've known you for 17 years now, so I know every word you're about to utter.
That's true.
But as a civil libertarian, deep down in my bones, if a place is zoned okay for any religious group to build – they should be able to build. The attack had nothing to do with Islam. I'm looking here at a list, and I didn't count them up. But there are a list of at least a couple hundred people who died on 9/11 in those Twin Towers who are Muslims.
Right.
And for us to deny an Islamic center the right to build because a majority of Americans think it's wrong – has nothing to do with it.
But nobody's disputing the right to build. What's being disputed is whether this is a good idea, whether this is something that the public supports. Nobody, to my knowledge, I mean, I don't mean literally that doesn't exist a person who takes this position, but there is no wellspring of opinion that argues that they should be legally prevented from building this mosque. The argument is that it is improper, that
why?
It is in bad taste.
Why do you think it's improper?
I think it's improper for the analogy I gave, which is that if the Jewish Defense League had bombed the area and then they wanted to erect a temple in that same area, it would have seemed inappropriate.
I was looking at just the opposite. If I saw that any group that was fanatical from any religion who created an act of terror against other human beings, and there are people who were of goodwill, like the Sufis and other many Muslims are, who say, we want to build something where all human beings can come together in peace out of our religion. That, to me, is a good step. So I don't agree with that at all.
And also, he's always been based in that area. I mean, it's not like they were like, oh, let's just go as close to ground zero as possible. They had been looking – the mosque that he had been leading, because a friend of mine was going to his mosque, it was overcrowded for quite a while. Then they found this building, which is a Burlington Coat Factory, which is not in view. If you're at ground zero, you're not all of a sudden going to see a mosque or an Islamic center or whatever. You're not going to see it, just like you won't see the strip club. I mean, people talk about it's a holy area, but people aren't talking about tearing down the strip club. People aren't talking about tearing down the mosque that's already within four blocks, because New York City is a very compact area. You have everything right around. So again, the only reason to be opposed to it is because you are saying that because someone Muslim did this act, that means that no Muslims should be able to build anything related to Islam, and that's just bigotry. And maybe
no,
70
that
and
is I do, not that, that,
that's clearly
no,
bigotry.
It's sensitivity for the analogy.
A lot of whites
are
very sensitive about having blacks come into their schools. That was bigotry.
Let me say that the history of Imam Ralph is not undisputed. There are those who say that he has a history of having made anti-Israeli remarks.
Oh, wait a minute. That kind of stuff really annoys me. Can I tell you why?
Well, okay.
Because it's one thing to say something that's anti-politically about Israel.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're an anti-Semite.
No, it does. Nothing
to do with that. And he may have those views. But he is also a Sufi, and the Sufis follow a path in Islam, which is a very peaceful path in Islam. And they are denigrated, much like Quakers were denigrated in the Christian world, for the path they take.
And he's a paid pro-Western speaker by the United States government.
I understand.
I mean, many Muslims say he's a paid agent of the United States government.
But if there is evidence that is not consonant with a stipulation, you ought to at least allow for that.
I must say that when I see evidence coming from Fox TV, I just don't believe it
immediately. I believe automatically.
Here's the problem, and you mentioned Dr. King, and Stride Toward Freedom is the book written in 1958 at age 29 about the Montgomery bus boycott. In 1956, when he was 27. In fact, Dr. King deferred endlessly in these events to people who were just flat out wrong on the merits, just flat out 100% wrong. I mean, just totally historically wrong in ways that he forgave them for because he was taught that by the law of ethic of Jesus.
But he didn't stop the monk. But
no, that's right. That's right. That's absolutely correct. And if someone said that no one should be allowed to build an Islamic center anywhere in New York, that would be ludicrous, and obviously that would not be a good thing. I would just say that because this Islamic center could do a great deal of good in New York City, it would have been better if groundwork had been laid, because right now there's going to be terrible fighting about this. It may go on and do tremendously good things at the proposed site, but there's going to be a tremendous, ugly, stupid fight, most of it being stupid, some of it not being – a lot of it being stupid. And it stands to do a lot of harm. It stands to produce a lot of – and if there were a way to produce the good that could come from this project – without bringing on that fight, I just think it would have been wiser to it's not a failure of people that they aren't political geniuses, but they did not see this coming.
Wait,
I assume.
Let me open the phone so that folks come in that before we move into switch gears and talk about the speeches by Barack Obama, his announcements about the tax, one of the tax cuts for the rich to go, and what's going to happen in November. 410-319-8888. First to Garrett in Baltimore. You're on the air. Hi, Garrett. You're on the air.
I just wanted to, first of all, say that as I was talking to a friend of mine about this today, he said that he remembered like the World at War that used to come on TV when he was a kid. And this guy said, when you see people burning books, like this guy down in Gainesville is going to burn a Quran, they will burn books. And then the next thing you know, they're burning people. And I also want to say that when the mosque is built in New York, because it will be built, because it's quite simply the right thing to do. And if Martin King were here today, he would be absolutely fervently voicing the right of these Muslims to build a mosque there.
We're all very good at speaking for Dr. King. Go ahead.
Let's not forget that that Muslims were also killed in 9/11. And I don't want to try to dominate the airwaves. But, I just want to be one of those. I'm almost ready to go down to Gainesville and protest. The only thing is I don't have enough money to do it. So anyway, I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you so much.
Garrett, thanks so much. Let's go to another caller here first. And this is Eric in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Yes, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
This question is for the panelists. Do you think that what's happening now with the whole controversy over the building of this center, is there a precedent, do you think, historically about people being persecuted and then religious edifices being built? Because, I mean, black people were killed in the name of Jesus and crosses are burned. That's a representative of people being racist, and I've never heard no one speak about that yet. It seems to me, and I want the panelists to speak to this, that we're historically, religiously, morally cowards. We will not speak to what happened to black people and the native people that were in this land. And then I guess because this is happening now, so we kind of can deal with this, we can bash Islam, we can say what Muslims should do and shouldn't do. But look what happened to us. Is that not terrorism? Is that not worse than terrorism? And I have never heard one black person talk about burning the Bible or tearing down a church. Our churches were burned back then. You know what I'm saying? And it's like nobody speaks to that. Is it because we just saying, okay, well, it's in the past. It doesn't matter anymore. I don't believe there's ever going to be peace like it should be in this country until the two people who suffered the most with the building of this country, and that's the natives that were here and the descendants of the blacks that were brought from Africa, until that's addressed, there's never going to be peace or justice, I don't think, amongst any people. And I want the panelists to speak to that. Thank you.
Eric, thank you so much. Let's have some comments on our last two callers before we...
Well, I've been, it's just a sort of a point of curiosity for me, partly because of the discussion about Dr. King that came up around the Glenn Beck event. That's what sort of what interested me in going back and rereading some of Dr. King's early writings. Stride Toward Freedom was his first book. Dr. King came up in a period of Southern terrorism. It's staggering. There's a new book out, Freedom Summer, right now, about the 1964 SNCC freedom schools and voting drives in Mississippi.
Freedom Summer, the book is called.
Yeah, Freedom Summer.
Yeah, we're going to be interviewing you soon.
If you – just reading that book, it's staggering to recall what – the culture of the state of Mississippi was like in 1964. It's stunning. It's staggering. I mean, it's not that it isn't things that people have always known, but it's a very well-written, clearly written book. And yes, I mean, Dr. King, when he was putting his ideas together for how to confront this culture, said he, as a young man, he was searching for techniques that would help deliver oppressed people. He referred to blacks in the South as an oppressed people. He searched through the philosophers of the world for techniques that would work, and he finally paired the love ethic of Jesus with nonviolent resistance of Gandhi and said he felt he had a technique that could free oppressed people such as those in the South. So that's a staggering part of American history.
And incidentally, I have always argued, and I sometimes assume people know this, whether they do or not, that good conservatives worship the history of Martin Luther King. And Martin Luther King personified courage. Rhetorically, he was one of the most brilliant speakers this country has ever known. I mean, Martin Luther King
was
a hero.
But conservatives are against his policies.
Well, but now why do you say that?
Because King's socioeconomic policies were quite clearly progressive, bordering on what people would call today socialist.
But the policies that we may have supported at the time and may not support now does not mean that we oppose what he would support now were he alive.
Conservatives didn't support what he was advocating for and they wouldn't advocate those same type of policies today.
They wouldn't today because the situation
and they didn't yesterday. I think blacks weren't just oppressed yesterday. I think blacks are oppressed people today, and Native Americans are oppressed people today.
In
the United States of America. America. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Native Americans, African Americans. I do
de jure,
believe.
De jure?
Sorry.
By law? Do you think African Americans are oppressed by law in the United States?
Clearly by the legal system. If you look at any type of analysis of who's incarcerated in this country and the rate of incarceration, that's clear.
Well, tell me why that constitutes discrimination.
Tell you why the fact that even though whites use illegal drugs at the same level as blacks, but blacks are much more likely to be incarcerated for it, why that's discrimination? To me, that's self-evident.
And that's the definition of discrimination. We'll take a break and contemplate that and come back and talk some more about it. We're here with Dietrich Muhammad, Bas Fornby, Richard Vass, and you at 410-319-8888. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Up-to-date information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and I want to tell all area jazz vocalists and musicians that you're invited to a historic photo shoot. A great day in Baltimore, Monday, September 13th, 9 a.m. at the War Memorial Plaza in downtown Baltimore. That's this Monday. The photo shoot will bring together local and regional musicians in Baltimore's rich musical history, past and present, in support of jazz in the city. Proceeds from the photograph will benefit the UB Blake Cultural Center's jazz workshop programs. For more information, call Mia Miata at 443-204-1730. That's, pardon me, that's 443-204-1730. We're here with Richard Vatz, who is a professor in the Department of Mass Communications and Communication Studies at Towson University and a frequent contributor to RedMaryland.com. Bob Sorenby, editor of the Daily Howler. Dudu Mohammed, co-founder of Race and Economic Policy Forum. And senior organizer and research associate for the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Something is getting to me here in this early. I don't know what it is. 410-319-8888.
Lord's vengeance.
I'd have been struck down long ago if that was the case. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation. I want to kind of switch gears for a minute and talk about, because we ended up and we talked during the break about Martin Luther King and how his policies at the and his beliefs as he got to the end of his life when he was assassinated were more and more politically radical, economically radical, calling for a guaranteed income, calling for massive investments in the country, calling for an end to poverty in this country and building a movement of poor workers in America to change it. And people were more worried about that in many ways than they were about his civil rights work, I think, as he got to that point in his life. But we're at a similar point in America now where we have a staggering huge unemployment number, 9.6, if you add to that the numbers of people in America who have given up looking for work who have
– those who are employed at a lower level than they would
have the numbers are 17 – that's almost 17% of Americans. You add to them people who are making less money than they ever did before, and we're talking about large numbers of American people. And we're seeing an election come up some say the Republicans will take back the House and the Senate. I was just reading Robert Creamer just now in the Huffington Post, who's putting his money on that's not going to happen. The opposite is going to happen because he thinks there'd be the other message is going to win out. But we can talk a bit about that. Vis-a-vis President Barack Obama's last two announcements, the speech today he gave in Cleveland. Some people who say it was too late. He should have done that at the very beginning of his presidency. People aren't going to listen to him now as they would have then. And others saying that it's time to go. And his other speech saying that he's not going to keep the tax cuts for the most wealthy in America. So, so gentlemen, talk a bit about where you think we are with all that and where you think your analysis of that speech today and what you think we're about to see in the next month and a half here.
I think the most fascinating thing about President Obama right now is going to come after the election, which is that his President Barack Obama's debt commission may actually be responsible for producing cuts to Social Security benefits for regular people. And I just think that's a staggering fact. I assume that was impossible for most of this past year, but I've begun to realize, no, that actually may happen. It's a staggering fact about the way our society is working now that we could even be thinking about that, that a liberal Democratic president could even be thinking it. It's not him. It's his commission, but he's the one that put it together. I would take that as a sign that we live in a society now which is run increasingly by oligarchic power, which runs both parties. It runs the media. We hear ludicrous accounts of every major political issue, including Social Security, which I've heard ludicrous disinformation about for 30 years, leading to this point where a liberal president's commission may be about to reduce benefits for regular people under Social Security. It's a stunning fact. That's why I say again and again, regular people liberals and conservatives are all being ripped off by oligarchic power. We're all being ripped off by our health care. We're all being ripped off in every way, and we can't argue with each other about you're a bigot, you're godless, because divide and conquer is the way power always rules, and power is ruling thoroughly in this country today. You know, the stuff now is just pre-election hubbub, it's what's going to happen in November that's really – I think it'll be a staggering event if President Obama's debt commission suggests reducing future Social Security benefits and moves it successfully.
Yeah, I would still think that's politically impossible. I still think across the political divide, many would rebel against the cuts in Social Security. I guess we'll see how it's laid out, but I do think it's interesting, Obama's speech today, and I think what we're seeing is Obama is on his, it just started really campaigning for the November elections. And I don't want to underestimate, actually, the possibility of effectiveness he might have. Now, when I say effectiveness, what I mean is cutting down Republican victories. Republicans are clearly going to gain seats. Like, that's obvious. The question is, are they going to gain enough seats to take the House? Could they take the Senate? Most people doubt the Senate. People are increasingly saying that Republicans could take the House. I still think there's a good chance that Democrats could hold on to the House. They're definitely going to lose a lot of seats. And you know, looking at the speech, Obama's really trying to go back into his, you know, we are one country, there are common sense solutions, and here's what I'm going to do, and here's middle of the road. Now, policy-wise, I think, as before, it's too little too late to really – America is in a much more serious economic crisis, middle-class America, working-class America, than his policies are actually dealing with. It's still too much – let's help corporate America a little bit here, and somehow this is going to increase employment, which I see no evidence of. So I saw a lot of criticisms of his policy, but I think the politic is interesting, and it might bring some results, which might help Democrats not lose as many seats as people are expecting right now.
Or he could start a new war, which is how Bush handled it.
Well, let me just say a couple reactions.
You already have two.
I know, but he needs one of his own.
God.
That's how you win elections, Richard. Come on.
Well, there's something to that. Obama is apparently announcing a couple of policies in which he wants business to be able to deduct 100% from new equipment, whereas I think now can be deducted 50%. It would give business $200 billion. It would only cost the Treasury $30 billion because during the payback, apparently the actual cost to the government would be $30 billion. There have been other suggestions that were mentioned by USA Today and the Washington Post, including tax breaks for creating jobs. But the problem that I see, and God knows I'm not an economic expert, and I also like to talk about foreign policy a little bit, is that this doesn't really help small businesses. I mean, the real issue, it seems to me, and again, I don't wish to claim any great expertise on this, is that small businesses don't buy hard equipment. I mean, this isn't an advantage for small businesses across the country. This is an advantage for the very businesses that the Democrats have claimed get all the breaks, and maybe they do. But why not consider small businesses? Why not give small businesses breaks? Why not give them breaks for hiring people? When he wants to make permanent business tax credit for research and development and spend $50 billion on 150,000 miles of roads, you know, what advantage does this bring to small businesses across the country? So some of this, I think, is good policy, but it doesn't go far enough. And when he says that, when you talk about homes in which they make over $250,000 or individuals make over $200,000 and these people are the wealthy people, these are also small businesses. And small businesses need the break to get the economy moving, to deal with unemployment. And I don't see that in his trying to keep the left happy that he's really going to go all the way in making significant economic changes.
All these proposals, whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, they're all relatively little stuff in the face of a gigantic economic slew of despond, which represents the end of 30 years of massive growing inequality. Big corporate power massively rules. That's what we're looking at now. These are small proposals. I'm not saying this to blame Obama. Obama didn't create that. But these proposals are tiny compared to the giant problem we're facing, and neither party, no one in our mainstream discourse is really discussing the giant size of our problem.
And that's why I wonder if Republicans might have hit their height of kind of backlash a little too early, as there's more of a debate, as Obama can lead more of a national debate, and as people really see that there aren't, I don't think, any clear, because I don't think the problem is small business. The problem isn't that big businesses aren't making enough money. That's not the problem. The problem is that working America has been in an economic economic slowdown and too oftentimes decline for decades.
But the whole point
of how are we
breaks,
going to address
the whole
that?
Point of giving breaks is to hire more people.
But we've been giving breaks and companies aren't hiring more people. What companies are doing is they're holding on to that money to try to see, you know, because companies' goal is not to hire people. It is to make money. It is for profits. And so the easiest way, and this isn't popular, the easiest way for the government to create a job is actually create a job.
Well, but that doesn't help the economy.
Oh, it does help the economy. I mean, Maryland is the richest state, highest income state in the country. It's because there's so many federal government jobs that have been able to keep going during this recession. Government jobs do a lot for the American economy. It's actually, I think, like 20%, I think,
but
of
the question
American
is whether
economy.
Government jobs are good for the economy with all the baggage they bring in, or whether private industry, incenting private industry, is the way to go. And I think this administration believes that the answer is in government, and I think that the answer is in private industry.
No, the problem is the administration actually believes too much in private industry. It's been giving away too much of private industry.
What are they giving to small businesses? Where are the plans which would make a significant difference to small businesses?
Let me open the phone so you can get see what folks are thinking about this. 410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello?
Mike, you're on the air.
One, the small businesses already being worked with the tax cuts for the middle class, because the great majority of small businesses are fall under that cap. That's one. Capital expenditures will help small businesses for planning equipment as that expands. But it seems to me there's always this disconnect because I think conservatives largely have misunderstood economics. I mean, they have misunderstood having a market-centered economy with plutocracy and the corporatism that one of your panelists discusses. And these are not the same thing. And I mean, if a person is in private sector and then all of a sudden goes to work for government, they take all of that intelligence with them. So this ruse about government being evil is all part of a narrative of socialism that has political ends. But when you look at the actual policies and impacts, I mean, the argument between socialism and Marxism is last century. That has been settled. It's about markets, but it's about tempering those markets. And when markets are not working efficiently and effectively, when they cause externalities, that is the role of government. And so when you create spending in targeted areas where you need a greater capacity and infrastructure, and you support private sector toward those areas through government stimulus, you are actually doing things which support the market. But this labeling and this notion that somehow there's this socialist boogeyman is not.
How about calling it a ruse? Is that labeling?
No. It's because it is. Because listen, I mean, and to go back to an earlier comment, you disputed whether de jure versus de facto racism. See what the problem with conservative thinking is, you don't seem to understand systemic influences. So when I start talking to you about systemic racism, you just shut down. Like you have no, because here's what it comes down to: assets equal liabilities plus equity, right? So the fact is, we've overinvested in wealthy people's assets. We underinvest in human assets. And if we want to see the total enterprise value of America increase, we won't focus completely on our liabilities like the history of racism. We'll make equity investments.
Mike, let me let our panelists kind of have at what you were saying for a moment.
Well, I'll just add in that. I mean, I think the caller brings up a very good point that the tax cuts – I think over 90% of small businesses would be positively affected. Small businesses that file under individual income tax would benefit from that. And so, I mean, that would be a tax cut that would overwhelmingly help small businesses. This whole idea that most small businesses make over $250,000 a year is ridiculous.
Well, the ones that the Wall Street Journal made the argument, I believe, that it is the larger small businesses which hire more people, and to the extent that you disincent them from hiring people, you are hurting. You're raising the unemployment level.
There's billions of dollars sitting on the sidelines. Capital isn't the issue.
That is true.
There is so much money sitting on the sidelines chasing such few good deals. Listen, that's a.
All right, Mike. I'm sorry. I didn't do that, Mike. Whatever happened to you, just let you know that I didn't hang up on you. 410-319-8888. You want to say anything about that, Bob?
Well, there is a gigantic amount of money sitting on the sideline. The question of why it's doing that, of course, money doesn't sit there by itself. Someone decides to keep it there. There are different narratives as to why that's happening. But we have a rolling economic disaster in this society, which the likes we haven't seen since President Roosevelt. And small bore discussions about which tax cut would be better just don't rise to the larger question of how we got here and how big money and big power control not only both parties, but control almost all the narratives we hear about major issues like tax policy, Social Security.
One of the things that Matt Bai wrote today in the New York Times right after President Barack Obama's speech, I was reading a bunch of articles and commentaries from all sides. He said it was really interesting. One of the things he said was he thought that that the president needed to respond in two very distinct ways, he wrote here. And he said it may be too late for him to do it. He should have done it when he has 70% of the people in America behind him. He said, first, spending the hundreds of billion dollars in the short term to avoid depression, which they did, but it didn't get spread out very much and didn't do much to the American people. He said the other is by making a series, and this is what Paul Krugman argues a lot, of large-scale investments to modernize the foundation of the economy, building the infrastructure of America, building the broadband infrastructure, building the education system, rebuilding the literal infrastructure of America, railroads, and then putting – that builds private businesses that build the infrastructure and keep them going. So the infrastructure is there and the marketplace can flourish all around the infrastructure.
But to do that, we need a societal agreement among all of us that this is where we want our society to go. And societally – we are arguing over culture war issues again, and that destroys any capacity.
So Paul Krugman thinks that we don't have a large enough stimulus package, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I can't argue with the Nobel laureate because I'm sure that his errancy has something behind it. But if you look at Paul Ryan's arguments, if you look at the arguments of conservatives, you know, if you look at the arguments on the health care costs, you know, the claim that insuring 41 million more people is going to save us money. I mean, this is, you know, this kind of argument is so patently absurd, it seems to me.
Oh, but now, that wouldn't be absurd because, I mean, 41 million people being insured, when people get hurt, when they still end up going to the emergency room, we're still paying for their costs. And so part of the idea is that by giving them, you know, like upfront costs and health care upfront, we're going to save money down the line that's much more expensive in emergency room. So it's not patently false. You can disagree with it, but it's not like absurd in any way.
Well, let me say why it's absurd, okay? The Congressional Budget Office has now said that healthcare will cost $115 billion more than anticipated, and this is even before it's enacted. This is even before it goes into play. There are extraordinary costs. There's paperwork. There are so many overwhelming problems with the healthcare program that it becomes unviable. Non-viable.
But the problem with the bill from the beginning, it never dealt with costs, and it was supposed to deal with coverage. And it didn't do that.
Never discussed. This discussion never occurred in our media about why it is that we spend 2 to 3 times as much per person as every other country in the developed world. Literally, we discussed this on this show last year. Never discussed. Another discussion where you see, by some magic, the most obvious questions never arise in our public discourse. Why? I can't tell you.
Let me open the phone to you again, if I might, gentlemen. 410-319-8888. Halim, you've been holding on for a while. You're on the air.
Yes. How y'all doing?
Well, all welcome.
Right. Okay. You're discussing the economy now. I'm a firm believer in the do-for-self philosophy. And I don't believe that poor people are going to get the benefits. I mean, if they do get a benefit, it's going to be a trickle-down benefit, which is hardly a benefit at all. I think that the only way that we will survive this economy is to have a paradigm shift from waiting for government, waiting for the private sector, waiting for anybody to do something for us, and for us to take matters into our own hands. There's a whole new economy that is being built, the world economy, and there are products that are available that are very, very inexpensive. I mean, we can import, export. There's so many opportunities that individuals can take advantage of with little money and open up businesses and hire their families and push the paradigm and create opportunities for themselves as opposed to waiting for somebody to do it for them.
Well, I'll comment on that. Like, I'm very much a supporter of a do-for-self philosophy, but I don't believe there are so many opportunities to go out there and start businesses and hire your family, because if there were that many opportunities, we wouldn't have a 9 12.5% unemployment rate, a 16.3% unemployment rate for blacks, and then you put in underemployment, it would be almost 25% of the black population. So, but I understand what you're saying in that it is true, and this has been a problem with Obama, is that for the working class person, it is pretty much trickle down. And what the first thing that Obama did to stabilize the economy was take care of Wall Street, take care of some major corporate sectors, and then we eventually will get a little bit to some working class people. Here's a little tax cut here, these types of things, and that hasn't been enough. And instead, we've had increases in unemployment. So, you know, poor people will do what they've always had to do and figure out a way to survive on their own, but we still should be fighting for greater equity when the government is investing billions of dollars all the time into the wealthiest of Americans. We should at least be fighting, not standing there waiting, but at least fighting for equal investment into our communities as well.
May I make a parenthetical remark?
You may, then we'll turn it over to Bob.
Yeah, I just want to say that focusing on the economic problems of this administration when they are dwarfed by the foreign policy failures of this administration is doing them a big favor, even though it's not doing them much of a favor.
Well, continuing that favor, which I don't really regard as much as a favor, because I think I must say the economic situation strikes me as more obviously horrendous. Well, I just don't know what to say. I mean, I just think, you know, there's a series of articles being posted at Slate this week by Timothy Noah, a long time. It's sort of amazing that he's doing this. He's kind of a long time mainstream guy. A series of articles on inequality. It's staggering to look at what has happened to inequality, income inequality over the last 30 years.
The Inequality and Common Good Project at IPS helped put some of that together.
Well, you know, I'll just recommend, though, there's a big discussion that isn't going on. So-called liberals aren't pushing it. Conservatives aren't pushing it. The mainstream press corps will never push it. I'm amazed that Slate is doing it this week. There's a big discussion about the way in which our society now works to serve wealth that just isn't really going on anywhere, and especially not from liberals, who you would think would be the ones to raise it. Liberals aren't raising it.
But one critique I'll give of that article and a little bit of a critique of what you've been saying earlier is this idea that by dealing with racial inequality, we are deviating from the primary point. It's a bad analogy in his article, and he does kind of hint at that throughout the article, and it's bad in this discussion.
In whose article?
In Slate.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
He consistently goes back to the idea that he tries to pose racial economic inequality and says, see, that's not the problem.
Oh, right, okay.
The problem
is
growing economic inequality as a whole, instead of highlighting how growing economic inequality as a whole has been the major barrier to racial inequality in this country. He could have made it much more inclusive. Going back to Dr. King, there's a reason why King was fighting against concentration of wealth when he was alive.
Well, King was living in a socialist utopia compared to what income is like. I mean, really, compared to what income distribution is like today.
It was a racist.
No, absolutely.
It might have been a utopia for
excluding this is excluding, you know, racial distributions in the Deep South.
And the North, and
yeah,
in Boston.
Well, it was
and
worse than the Deep
places.
South.
But there was violence and segregation, massive segregation.
I'm talking
in the
about
North.
Economic distribution. I'm just saying, and this starts in 79 is where most people are tracing this from now. But it's just a staggering growth of economic inequality, and it's the discussion. It's the big, puzzling economic stuff. The only thing I'll say about cultural issues, including racial issues, is, yes, they have to be pursued. But when we're facing such a gigantic problem in which everyone on the left, everyone on the right is being crushed by economic power, we have to be sure we're not just getting into shouting matches over whether the cultural center is two blocks over or six blocks up, because that's what power wants us to do.
Racial inequality, though, is not a cultural issue.
No,
it's an economic issue.
I'm just saying we need to pick our arguments wisely, unless we just don't care.
So how do you feel about investments in global warming? Do you feel that that's a propitious time to make those investments? Do you think that that's sufficiently?
Well, since we're out of time, I'll say
yes. Okay.
There you go.
Way overdue. That's a subject we'll cover with a theory coming up that people haven't heard about yet, who we're going to bring out on this airwaves, about how you really build solar in America. But that's another day.
Oh, man.
Richard Batts, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mark. Much enjoyed.
Bob, thank you so much.
Same here.
Mr. Muhammad, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll going to tackle the inequality question next week with some folks from IPS and some other people, and maybe even get Bob Swimmer back so they can get varying viewpoints on this. I might even let you back, Richard. We're not sure yet. Of course, you're always welcome here. You know that. And folks, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, www.umm.edu/heart. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back at the top of the hour, we are going to hear a conversation with the great mystery novelist of Baltimore, Laura Lippman. Stay with us.